How real number five.
Now, when you went to France in the early summer of 1916, you were posted 240 Squadron in Lille Villas. What kind of duties did 40 Squadron have?
They did offensive patrols and bomber escort. Bomber escort was the first time I really flew in formations during that. We used to fly four machines in a diamond formation, and we flew over the bombers, the big machines. They used to fly around about 5,000 or 6,000 feet, and we would go up to about 10,000. But, of course, our enemy at that time was the Fokker. And the one thing about the Fokker was it had a ceiling which was so high that it left every RFC aeroplane standing like a goldfish in a bowl with its nose up and not getting up at all. We could not reach it. And the Fokker system was to get up high and wait. And when it was up at about, say, 17 or 18,000 feet, we would come waffling along at about 10, and they would then dive down on our bombers. But they had to go first through the fighter cover above the bombers, and then through the bombers. I remember on one occasion, I had, apart from my normal flight of three other pilots making a diamond formation, I had a pupil who had only just been posted to France. And I had to take him out for his first lesson. And I told him for his position in formation, he was just to stick onto my tail. Wherever I went, he was to go. I used to fly with one aircraft out on the left of the bomber raid, bomber formation, and one out on the right, and one at the back. And I kept a roving commission over the center so that I could go to either right or left to back him up. This boy, he said, "Where shall I fly?" And I said, "Well, you stick onto my tail." Now, that one morning was most extraordinary. It must have been the atmosphere that just suited my engine. My ceiling that I'd ever got to by that time, I think, was between 11 and 12,000. That morning, I flew on, and I went on, and my aircraft climbed and climbed and climbed until I got the highest I had ever been, which was just under 16,000. I had forgotten about this poor boy who was thousands of feet below me, who couldn't keep up. And I, of course, being so fascinated, wanted to see what was my ceiling. At that time, of course, the next thing I saw was a Fokker gentleman who'd been waiting for us. He was up at the height of normal Fokker flying, about 17,000. Well, a Fokker, as you know, was a monoplane, and we were almost at the same height. And as he came towards me, I couldn't for the life of me see whether he was German or French. It might have been a Fokker, it might have been a Morane. All I saw was the leading edge of the plane, and until I could see a mark, I couldn't fire. Well, he came at me. I suppose he'd only be about something like 100 feet higher when he started to come at me. I sat and waited until I heard his gun go. And as soon as he did, I grabbed my Lewis gun. But I was too late to get a shot at him. But as he passed, I saw the sun flash on his rudder. So I knew he's coming back again. And instead of following round, following him to the left, I pulled up and turned to the right, so that when I got round and he got round, I found myself about 100 feet above him. And I saw him look up and hesitate, and I was able to come down on him, fire, and he went down in a complete spiral all the way down, and he went clean through the bomber raid, which was about 10,000 feet below me. And I watched the tracer bullets from all the gunners in the our bomber formation, all firing at him. How they didn't hit each other, I don't know. But he went through that lot too. And where he finished, I expect he's probably down below or possibly up above now. But that was the end of my first experience of a Fokker. Incidentally, my personal view at the time, young though I was that formation flying was quite a menace. And the idea of formating a squadron on the ground to get into formation in order to take off wasted so much time that the normal way should be you get the alarm that there is a Boche raid or something like that, and you had to get there as quickly as possible. Therefore, each machine took off individually and got into formation on the way there. No time was lost, and we arrived together at the target. And this other method of lining up, which is very spectacular, and all roaring off together, you've wasted valuable operational time getting into formation on the ground, completely inactive. That is why I was against it, and why I still am against it. It's a wonderful spectacle, but I believe that in close formation flying, wingtip to wingtip, in fact interlocking wings, there's only one man who can use his eyes, and that is the leader. The others have to look inwards to make sure they don't hit the next aeroplane. So really, it doesn't matter how many aircraft you've got in a tight formation, the only man who can really look out, in my view, is the leader.
But were you actually concerned with wingtip to wingtip type formation flying at the time?
Not that time. Yeah. We spread out comfortably so that we had room to maneuver and dodge without hitting each other.
Yes. So that wasn't a problem at the time?
No.
Do you remember any actual occasions when formation flying created specific problems?
Yes, certainly I do. I remember I was coming back one evening, it was being at dusk. I'd been on an offensive patrol with my flight, that is, four aeroplanes in all, and got back to my aerodrome, and I saw, to my amazement, a lot of aircraft, all standing on their noses, crashed on our aerodrome. And I wondered whatever had happened. Had there been a bomb raid or something? And then I was quite certain it was my aerodrome. And so I came in. We had to come in and land in between these wrecks. When I got down, I found that it was a squadron that had just arrived in France, the commander being Major Sholto Douglas, later Marshal of the Royal Air Force. And his idea was formation. He was great on formation flying. They were supposed to come in and land in formation. That is, on a small grass airfield. The result I saw. And beyond that, and the next day, he formated his squadron again on this aerodrome to take off altogether in formation, which to me at that time I thought was just suicidal. I couldn't see any advantage, any point at all in it. Because our formation was merely, as soon as we got the alarm, we used to take off individually and come into formation on the way to the target, thereby saving time and getting there at the same time.
So this practice of forming up in formation on the ground before takeoff was really rather unusual?
Very unusual, and we thought it was completely mad. We couldn't see any advantage at all in that.
Did you ever have an opportunity to ask Sholto Douglas why he chose this particular mode? Did he have a rationale for it?
No, I asked him, of course, and I said I didn't agree with it. And of course, he was a major and I was only a three pipper. And I couldn't extend the argument, but I could have gone on at that time, very heated, all through the evening. But we didn't continue with that discussion. Another incident I remember very well was that when a squadron went off as the bomber force, the escort, which would be in the lighter and faster machines, used to wait and take off afterwards. And we came on while the bomber force was going round and round and round waiting for the off. We used to climb underneath them and come up through them, sort of like going through Piccadilly traffic, until we got up to our height, and when the leader of the bombing formation fired his light to start us off, we just followed along over the bomber escort. And uh, several times we would see the squadron of bombers, which were on an aerodrome some miles south of us. We'd see them take off and just judge our time as to whether when we were going to take off, to catch them up and get above them before they crossed the lines.
Were there any dramatic or noticeable differences in the pattern or intensity of flying operations during this period as compared with the earlier period in 1516 when you'd been with Fire Squadron?
Oh, yes, I think so. And the difference was that the Germans were far more numerous. In the 1915 early times, one could fly on an offensive patrol without even seeing a single Hun. But later, in the 1916 time, if one crossed the line, one could almost guarantee a fight in the air at that time. That's merely because they had increased, obviously, in number and in aggression. One disadvantage that the Royal Flying Corps had was that through the whole of the war, the prevailing wind, of course, was from the west, which meant that we were always blown over quickly over the German lines, and we had to fight hard against the wind to get back, whereas the Boche could just nip over against us, and as soon as he was attacked, he turned tail and was way home before we could catch up. And that was one of the disadvantages from the beginning to the end of the First World War. Yes, this wind problem was brought to my mind on returning from a bomb raid, as I was the escort, and I saw the leader of the escort, who was flying an FE-2B, that is a big thing with a Beardmore engine. I think it went up to 120 horsepower, Beardmore. And that was a big two-seater pusher. And I saw the leader being attacked and bothered by a Hun. And every time he turned towards the Hun turned east, which was very nice. I went in to his assistance, thinking that the two of us together would be able to get this fellow. Instead of which, to my horror, as soon as I arrived, he pushed off. So he got back, but it left me with this beastly thing stuck on my tail. Every time I turned towards him, he turned east. And every time I turned to come home, he turned west, following me. Well, obviously, the result is going to be that I'm going to be about 20 or 30 miles over the German lines by the time, and no petrol. And I had to just leave him and try and struggle back. And it's a very trying thing when you look down and see the leading edge of your plane on a certain object on the ground, and then suddenly find that you look again after what seems about 10 minutes, and you look down and there's the same object and the same edge of the plane, and you don't appear to have moved at all. It's most horrifying. I did a patrol with the old Vickers fighter, which I used to fly at the best climbing speed was 45 miles an hour. I once did a two-hour patrol with that, with my tail over the German lines the entire time. I couldn't go across against the wind, which was blowing at about 50 miles an hour, without going backwards. And that was rather fascinating, to be flying in one direction and seeing the earth go in the other way. And the only way I could gain against the wind was to come down to the ground, which I did for 2 hours in a number of large circles, climbing at the end and going backwards, and then diving and coming down low down. So really, in effect, I was completely hopeless. My gunner was just standing, turning round the other way and looking over the top plane. And that is how I did a two-hour patrol.
Now, when you weren't actually flying, how did you tend to pass your time?
Oh, we made ourselves, apart from the usual cheery cheeries in the mess, which had to be done because it's the only hope one had when one's best friend was lost on the patrol that afternoon, was to get cheery as possible to avoid the crying and keep up the morale. But we had an added incentive because our CO was this famous actor airman, Robert Lorraine. And he found a hut. It was a Red Cross hut which he saw, and he'd noted that nobody seemed to own it, and all the officers went off in cars. We dismantled the hut and we brought it back to our own aerodrome and built it again. We had a wonderful theatre. It had a stage. It would hold about 250, and we used to do odd things like plays. We actually acted two unpublished plays of Bernard Shaw's. And to our intense delight, who should arrive to stay with us as a VIP for a week but Bernard Shaw himself? At that time, I think it was in John Bull, I had seen an article from Bernard Shaw urging young men not to enlist. And I said to Lorraine, you know, there is a job for a public assassin, a fellow trained by the government to kill people like this. One week afterwards, who should arrive but Bernard Shaw himself? Lorraine introduced me and said, oh, Shaw, he said, this is Pearl. This is the boy who wants to shoot you. And Shaw said, how do you do? I'm very pleased to meet you. And, you know, you might have chosen somebody worse. We were acting a play, and Lorraine at dinner excused himself and said, I've got to go down. We're doing a dress rehearsal for the men, The Inca of Jerusalem, one of your plays, Shaw. And he said, Pearl, will you bring Shaw down as soon as he's finished his meal? So I took Bernard Shaw down to the theatre, and I sat on a seat below him, just behind him. And I was horrified to see that all the way through this play, he roared with laughter. He roared so much that he actually cried and brought out a handkerchief to wipe his eyes. In those days, Shaw had a ginger beard, not white, but he was absolutely ginger, and I remember this beard wobbling up and down.